From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the festively decorated Argo Studios in New York City. These are good people here. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners like you, and we're very grateful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, December 21st marks the winter solstice, observed as Yule in both Christian and Wiccan pagan traditions. Wednesday is Christmas Eve, and Thursday is Christmas Day for Christians. And Friday, Zoroastrians will mark Zarathustra. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
So Pew Research Center asks American people, what do you think about torture? And they're largely okay with it. 51% say that they were justified. Only 29% say not justified, and 20% said don't know.
There's this notion that somehow there's moral equivalence between what the terrorists did and what we do, and that's absolutely not true. We were very careful to stop short of torture.
And facing cruelty, suffering, and loss, that we are always Americans, and different, stronger, and better than those who would destroy us.
The long-delayed release of at least a summary of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on CIA interrogation techniques earlier this month sparked widespread partisan finger-pointing. It should come as no surprise that in this day and age, there seems to be nothing that can't be politicized. But the long-term effects of engaging in torture won't be known for a long time. What is easier to evaluate in the present are the moral and ethical ramifications of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques and of this public disclosure. On this week's show, I'll be talking with the Reverend Ron Stief, Executive Director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture.
Hanukkah, Hanukkah, come light the menorah. Let's have a party with all.
The eight-day Jewish celebration of Hanukkah began Tuesday at sundown and continues through December 24th. Rabbi Irwin Kula, always an inspiring voice, will be back with us to talk about the significance of the Festival of Lights and what Jewish teachings can offer us as we prepare for a new year. But first,
it was another really big week for marriage equality, with couples in South Carolina and Montana legally tying the knot for the first time in history.
It would be a typical evangelical service were it not for the gay worshipers in the pews.
In many ways, 2014 was an exciting year for LGBTQ persons, including LGBTQ persons of faith. Several religious denominations have taken steps toward inclusion. We've seen evangelical activists lead pro-gay initiatives within their own tradition. And certainly great progress was made on the secular front toward recognizing the dignity and worth of same-gender relationships. At the same time, sexual minorities in some other parts of the world endured growing bias and threats, including institutionalized homophobia. The numbers always tell only part of the story. So for a close look at some of the lives impacted by these changes, I'm very happy to welcome the Reverend Pat Bumgardner, Senior Pastor of the Metropolitan Community Church of New York and Executive Director of the Global Justice Institute, back to State of Belief Radio. Pat, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Let's start with just a quick description of the Institute's mission for those who may not have heard you before or may not be familiar with it.
The Global Justice Institute was founded actually by metropolitan community churches to handle the social justice work or ministry of the church. And we separately incorporated with some structural ties remaining to the church so that we could work with people who sometimes are hesitant to work with faith bodies. The Global Justice Institute really carries on our efforts around public policy, around social justice efforts globally.
In the so-called elevator speech, someone says, what do you all do?
Well, we connect with activists and spiritual leaders on the ground in various locations who have dreams and hopes and plans and visions for how they would like to implement social change in their particular context. And we try to learn as much as we can from each other and together find ways that we can work together to support those local dreams.
Where has the concentration of your work been this past year?
This past year, we've continued our work throughout Asia. We have a lot of projects going on in China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Vietnam, and Malaysia. And we've also expanded into Central and Latin America, Costa Rica, Mexico, and Brazil. We've continued our efforts in East Africa and worked in a pretty concentrated fashion in the United States.
Pat, is there a common thread that runs through these places that make them the center of your focus?
The common thread, of course, is that LGBTI life is criminalized and in many, many different ways threatened. But what we're also discovering as we work in contexts outside the United States, although this is true in the United States also, is that LGBT rights, so to speak, LGBT social justice or social progress is intimately connected to other kinds of issues, women's rights, children's rights, the way people of color are criminalized in various locations around the globe, including particularly the United States. So some of what's happening for us, I think, is that we are really working at the crossroads or the intersections of oppression and trying to form coalitions that can address a broad range of issues and incorporate a broad range of people as we move forward.
You have people all over the world that are working in conjunction with you. And how do you get in touch with those people?
Mostly people initially contact us. You know, one of the benefits of being centered in New York is that people look to New York for contacts, for people that might be able to connect to their particular projects. So we get far more requests and far more information than we could ever deal with in 1 year. But people usually come to us. We usually have some kind of online relationship for a period of time. And we, as you know, go only where we're invited. So when we receive an invitation, then we go to explore the possibilities on the ground.
As you look back at 2014, is there a particular initiative that you're proudest of that brings you a lot of gratitude?
Well, I think one of the things I feel the greatest joy about is our work in Kenya. That work started a few years ago, and this year, a group we call Churches Against Discrimination has already met twice. It's a group of local religious leaders in Nairobi and the surrounding area, Metito Ande, who are exploring ways that they, not necessarily as LGBTI people, but just as people of faith, exploring ways that they can address the hostility and violence that's often targeted against LGBTQI people, and trying to come up with ways that on the ground they can address this and still not lose their pulpits, for example, because as you know, in many places of the world, if a person speaks up for queer rights or even against violence, they often lose their standing in their local religious context. So part of what has emerged in these contexts, especially in Kenya, is, okay, we can all agree that the Bible says thou shalt not kill. We may not all agree on what it says about gay people, but we can agree on that. And so let's start there and talk about how we should build community, how we should live together, how we should preach and teach based on that premise.
What's happened internationally in response to the really rapid progress that's been made in the United States? Has that been encouraging to other places, or has it made change in other places more difficult?
I think both. certainly those of us who are human rights activists see the connections between progress any place and try to use that to move forward around the globe. But I think, for example, in places like East Africa, Uganda, Kenya in particular, the movement for LGBT equality in the United States particularly, and watching state by state either embrace equality or lose its battle against equality has really fueled the fire, especially I think of Uganda and Russia, where those battles have gained a lot of media attention. And so legislators have really used the United States as an example of what they don't want to have in their countries.
Mm-hmm. When you deal with this prejudice, especially in the international community, is it a matter of bad theology? Is it a matter of superstition? Is it a matter of ignorance? Is it a matter of tradition? What is it that is causing the fear of taking steps toward inclusion in these places around the world?
Personally, I think that the issue against inclusion is neither tradition nor bad theology nor superstition nor any of those things, even culture. I think the issue is what I like to call a weapon of mass distraction. And I think that queer life serves as that mass distraction. So, for example, in Uganda, why isn't the main issue on the table oil resources in the north and the way the wealth from those resources is being commandeered by a very few people and the country is not benefiting from that? Or why isn't the issue the Lords of Resistance Army? Or why isn't the issue Ebola or AIDS and its continued spread? Why is the issue queer people? And I think the answer is it is a way for a very few people to keep the masses unfocused on what's really keeping a country from making the kind of progress that people on the ground would like to see.
Oh, that's a terrific insight. Am I correct in saying that the Global Justice Institute has expanded its advocacy work in the United States, responding to crises in the area of race and law enforcement?
You're very correct in saying that. I think that racial issues in the United States were always on the table for us in terms of public policy and things we wanted to look at or address or call attention to. But I also think that unfortunately, the particular violence of 2014, you know, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, even today, hearing on the news about George Tinney, a young child, really 14 years old, who was convicted of a murder he couldn't possibly have committed and executed 70 years ago, and hearing him be exonerated now. I mean, the issue of race is really right in front of us currently, and not that it hasn't always been, but it's just powerfully in front of us, somewhat thanks to the media. And I think this is our opportunity to really, across the board, look at the connections between race and all kinds of discrimination. And for us as white people, and I speak, you know, now from my particular location in the world, I think it's our real challenge right now is to step up to the plate and say, okay, I may not have done what I should have done in the past, but this is not about blame, and certainly this is not about mea culpa. This is about how do we move forward and make positive kinds of changes. And I think white people, and part of what we're doing in the public policy component of global justice, is saying to our churches, you must begin to engage people in conversations around race and racial equality and racial inequality. You have to stop fearing that you're going to make a mistake or say the wrong thing. You have to have these hard conversations and try to move forward together, because we really need to build inclusive communities, multicultural communities that can present a different vision to the world.
Hmm. I know that you go where you're needed, where you're asked to come. If you have your way with the Institute's priorities, what are they going into 2015?
Well, in 2015, I'm really hopeful that I will be able to return to Kenya and meet with our folks on the ground there, because we have a golden opportunity to purchase some property there in partnership, and to establish the first global justice center outside of the United States on the ground and run our operations in Africa from an African base. So I'm really excited about that because it's long been my dream that we could have satellites around the globe. And so while we endeavor currently to make sure that all of our emphasis arises from the ground up, this would really be a wonderful mm-hmm. opportunity to situate staff from Kenya, not from the United States, but from Kenya, and to support and empower people's work on the ground. I'm also hopeful that we can revitalize our work in Jamaica and various parts of the Caribbean. We currently are partnering with an effort in New Kingston, Jamaica, called Duane's House, which is a shelter for LGBTI people who have been thrown out by their families. And I'm hoping we can re-enliven our work for social change in the Caribbean.
For someone who wants to know more about this, how's the best way for them to look in on the Global Justice Institute?
We have a website at www.globaljusticeinstitute.com. You can email me at revpat@globaljusticeinstitute.com. Those are probably the two best ways.
Okay. Well, let me tell our listeners, and I'm proud to say this, that during this last year, I agreed to be a board member on the Global Justice Institute's board, and I am delighted to do that. I believe in what Reverend Pat's doing, and I am always glad you're here. Reverend Pat Bumgardner is a senior pastor of the Metropolitan Community Church of New York and executive director of the Global Justice Institute. This institute is doing vital work in addressing some of the greatest threats and dangers around the world. I hope you'll look in on the website and learn more about it. And Pat, it's always a special delight to spend time with you. And as always, I want to thank you again for coming to share some of this with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. You've been a great inspiration to us.
Thank you. It's over 600 pages long, and it's just the executive summary of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on CIA interrogation techniques. Predictably, the reaction has been utterly politicized. Some of the loudest voices have been those associated with the Bush administration, reducing the entire conversation to essentially anyone opposed to the use of torture must want the terrorists to win. And at the same time, there are plenty who seem to suspect those defending so-called enhanced interrogation as bordering on being brutal sadists. Well, neither of these cartoonish portrayals is accurate. After 9/11, many decisions were made out of panic and fear, not hate, and many of those decisions could have better reflected our national character without necessarily compromising our security. The most important questions for us are, what do these revelations mean in a shrinking world, and what do we do now? Joining me right at this moment is the Reverend Ron Steef, Executive Director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. Ron is a longtime friend. He is in an agency of extremely important influence. Ron, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be here.
Let's start with a global perspective. In a global sense, what do you see as the most significant revelations in this report?
Well, there's really three things in the report. First of all, I think it puts to rest for good, hopefully, and Senator McCain addressed this on the floor of the Senate as well as Senator Feinstein when they supported the release, that torture as an interrogation technique is absolutely and completely unreliable. And that gets to some of what you mentioned in your intro. The second thing, and this was not a report on the morality of torture, but in fact the conversation that it has sparked, again, with our president, with senators, with the media, and faith leaders across the country, is that torture is immoral. and should never, we should find ways to make sure it never happens again. The third one is that the United States is admitting to doing something wrong and has committed, although the conclusions don't commit us to a path to permanently end torture, has at least admitted that we did something wrong and has committed to make that right for all the world to see.
Ron, is there any part of the report that the Campaign Against Torture is skeptical about?
Well, no, I don't think we're skeptical about anything. In fact, we fought hard to keep the redactions to a minimum, and there will be follow-up to find out exactly where the law was broken and how the law was broken. But by and large, we believe that it showed the horrors of torture. I mean, not that anybody wants to have to see that, but it showed that it was worse than we thought it was. And it also showed a real coming to terms with where the CIA intentionally lied to Congress, intentionally tried to cover this up. And so we were actually pleasantly surprised with what we found. We did not know that it would go to that extent on either of those issues.
Well, Ron, let's take on what seems to be the major criticism here right up front. Does the report put Americans at risk of torture to hostile forces, as some critics just insist it does?
Well, there has been the word from the very beginning of this debate that if we go out there and really show the world what we did, then they're going to strike back at us. And I actually believe the opposite, and I think those of us who are in the faith community have argued the opposite, that in fact, when you tell the truth, then the conversation with your friends and enemies goes to a different level. Now, we can't control what anyone does based on any action that the federal government does. All we can do is continue to preserve the integrity of the democracy that is the United States. As Senator McCain said, he said, this is not about the enemy. This is about us. It's about who we perceive ourselves to be. That's what we have control over. And that's why the torture report has been so important to the faith community, because it is a piece of our history that now has been put at a higher moral ground in terms of how we talk about torture, terrorism, you know, other parts of violence worldwide and what the U.S. role is in that.
Ron, talk, if you will, about the ethical and moral aspects of what's in the Senate Intelligence Committee's report.
I think the ethical way, the ethics argument that happened there, although they didn't cover the morality of torture, what they were trying to establish is, does the CIA have a right and a responsibility on behalf of, you know, the American people to be out there and torture? And I think, as I said, the right has been taken away. There is no right in torture. And so then what's left is, okay, well, if it's an immoral act, is it a responsible thing for them to be doing? And again, because it produces no evidence, you have no rights or no responsibility to do that as the CIA. What that means as a moral category, if you will, is that this nation needs to get busy now, looking at President Obama's 2009 ban on torture, which is an executive order, and your listeners who know that through the recent actions on immigration will know that that is temporary. We need to make this permanent, and a couple of things can be done to make torture permanently banned from the anything that the CIA would ever do again in interrogations. We will be pursuing that in policy. This report lays the groundwork for that for next year.
Ron, I want to go from generality now to some very specific details. What does it do to the individuals involved and to a society as a whole when torture is practiced? We know something seems to be wrong with it. What's wrong?
Torture completely breaks down the individual who's tortured, and they are traumatized for life. We know that. We also know that many of those, as we've also heard with post-traumatic stress within the battlefield, many of those who do the torturing are also scarred for life. It also scars a society. And I think that's why these events happened years ago, and it's why the United States is still trying to come to terms with the fact that we did it. It has scarred our society. As Senator Feinstein said, it has put a stain on our reputation. That means a political leader who wasn't necessarily involved in any of the torture, but who was there for the conversations, has trauma over it as well. It is a societal issue. Now I think religious congregations in past times of torture have had to look at themselves and say, what is our role? It is a mass trauma when a society chooses to torture over other means of trying to relate to the world.
Isn't it true, Ron, that we can legislate definitions, but we can't define away torture? We may, by law, make some things acceptable, but what may be acceptable by law in this realm is not acceptable morally and ethically.
Well, and that's right, and that's actually what the Bush administration tried to do, is tried to redefine torture by calling it enhanced interrogation techniques. Well, guess what? Nobody but a small inner circle, who's being vocal now, but I think that will fade away, nobody but that small group really thinks anything but torture happened. So we can take steps, and they're easy. They're steps that have been applied to the Army that we can say, give the International Committee of the Red Cross access to who's being interrogated. Set some humane standards for interrogation. Actually get the CIA out of the business of detention. They shouldn't have been in it in the first place. Those three things, we can legislate morality in a sense here. If we pass those three laws or parts of a bill that may, you know, a rider to a bill that may come up next year, the CIA will no longer legally be able to torture, no matter what definition we'll put on certain techniques.
Ron, are you surprised at how polarized the nation is over this issue? It makes me wonder, is there room for common ground on this issue?
There ought to be, but there isn't yet. I believe that there's a path toward that. You asked me earlier what surprised in the report. Mm-hmm. Not much, but what has surprised me is how critics of the report have come out and said that this is a partisan issue. Mm-hmm. If you're on one side, if you're a Democrat, you believe that we shouldn't have done it. If you're a Republican, you believe we should have. I mean, that's essentially what they're saying, and I'm absolutely shocked by that response. And I think that what is going to have to happen is, I believe that this has, you know, for us, it's in the middle of a huge moral debate, but maybe for Congress now, this will launch a bit of a moral debate. It's a huge moral issue of our time. It's recognized as such. And I think Congress has a lot of catching up to do, as do all those who say this is a partisan issue. It is anything but a partisan issue. Torture impacts you, whether you're a Republican, Democrat, Independent, mm-hmm. whatever. You are affected by torture.
Ron, tell our listeners how to follow the work of National Religious Campaign Against Torture and support it.
Well, what you would want to do is take a look at our website, and we have actions that can be taken up there. You can see some of our 300 members, member organizations from around the country that are part of our movement. It is a movement that has been going for almost a decade now. We have 70,000 members across the country, individual members, and you can go to tortureisamoralissue.org. www.tortureisamoralissue.org, and you will find ways that you can plug in, and we are asking people to write letters to the editor, pen op-eds, really make the beliefs of the religious community known that this is a moral issue and we have something to say about it. Make it known now.
The Reverend Ron Steef is Executive Director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, a membership organization of more than 325 religious and faith-based organizations committed to ending U.S.-sponsored torture. Previously, Ron served as the Executive Director of the Washington, D.C. office of the United Church of Christ. That's where we got to know each other. Ron, I want to thank you for the work that you're doing. I mean, this is the moment, and I want to thank you for how effectively you are doing that work and passionately inspiring people to make some changes. And thanks for taking time out from all of that to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Welton.
The Jewish celebration of Hanukkah began this year at sundown on Tuesday and continues until December 24th. For a look at both the significance and the universally valuable teachings of the season, I'm delighted to be joined once again by Rabbi Erwin Kula, president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. Erwin, as always, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. Good to be here. Really good.
Summarize, if you will, the meaning of Hanukkah for followers of Judaism.
So it's the story is of a small ragtag army beating the empire and recovering political and economic and cultural and religious sovereignty over their lives. So it's a kind of one of those grand, you know, archetypal stories of the small beating the big and the powerless beating the powerful. And so in that respect, it's a drama of one little light, you know, winning out. And therefore, it turns out that there's a miracle story of when Judah Maccabee walks into the temple that had been desecrated in Jerusalem. He finds one cruse of oil. That cruse of oil is enough to last one day. He chooses to light the candelabrum in the temple, the menorah, and oil lasts 8 days, and therefore we celebrate for 8 days. But the story, I mean, I assume most people who observe the holiday, what it's really about is the sense that no matter how dark it gets, there is a possibility of light. However small the spark is and however hopeless it seems, there is always, as long as one is taking a breath, there is always some hope. And in that respect, it's very much like it's a version of what's the chance of a baby in a barn, in a manger, actually, you know, transforming a world.
Erwin, the powerful observance of Passover is really based in the home with the family gathering around the table. Is the home very involved in Hanukkah?
Actually, it's entirely home-based, and not surprisingly, it's the holiday that and the Passover Seder are the two holidays most observed by Jews. Above 70-75% of Jews observe those holidays, and they are both home-based, not synagogue-based. There's only one real official ritual, and that is the lighting of the menorah. One candle the first night, two candles the second, building up until your entire menorah is illuminated.
What are the most applicable teachings of Hanukkah to the situation that is the context in which Hanukkah happens year after year?
So I think that for right now, you know, I'm looking at the world and both on the larger global sense, but in America, and I think the two problems that seem to be most challenging right now, I'll call it the income inequality problem, or just the real unraveling of the social contract of people's responsibilities to other people, and the problem that we really have systemic problems in the justice system. And it's not bad people, good people. I don't want to make it a moral drama. It's an evolutionary drama. And in that respect, then I'd say Hanukkah says this. One, no matter how powerless you are, there are sources of power that you can reach into that can be transformative. And no matter how powerful you are, be careful imagining that you have so much power that you really can control other human beings. So that's message one. The powerless always have more power than they imagine, no matter how much they've beaten down, and the powerful never have as much power as they think they have. And that's a very humbling lesson for America right now. That's a humbling lesson for those of us who think we are privileged and those people who experience themselves as really voiceless. So that's the first. And the second is that this ongoing, constant human lesson that no matter how dark it gets, there is hope. And as long as we're taking a breath, and it's hard, and one has to practice hoping. Hoping isn't something that just comes to you. You have to practice hoping, just like you have to practice love, and you have to practice forgiveness. You don't get them automatically. You have to These days, you have a choice. You can look at the newspaper and you can look, surf the internet and you can see only bad news, or you can see profound hopeful stories all over. In fact, we have more access to hopeful stories now than we ever had before. And it's our choice. Do we do it, read 90% 10, right? Do we do it 80-20, or do we say, okay, we understand what's bad in the world, but what we need is more fundamental hope in the world, because that's the decision we make. It may only be 51-49, hope, but if it's 51-49 the other way, that's the opposite message, I would say, both Hanukkah and, in that respect, Christmas.
You are a person who reads the paper as well as the scriptures, and you know what's going on in the world as well as what's going on in people's souls and hearts. Where do you find hope?
So I think that there are, you know, a few places. First, in my family, and I'm very blessed, you know. I mean, I have I'm married for 34 years and a wife who's been really good to me and has tolerated a lot of craziness. I have five younger brothers who I speak to, and we work through whatever it is. I speak to them all at least once a week. Every brother speaks to every brother. So there's a family part that I really draw hope from. I have colleagues who are really good people who we keep an eye on each other, and you know Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, my closest colleague. Part of it is my predisposition to see beauty before ugliness. And that's a training. My mother played piano and was an artist, and my father was a musician and a cantor. So I think I picked things up from there to just, you have to make a decision to see the beauty. And then the other thing is, when I get too down, what I recognize is, and this is going to sound banal and trite, but, you know, it's just true. If you serve other people, and I don't mean some, you know, unbelievable sacrificial service, but it turns out when I'm feeling hopeless and I walk on the street and I realize, you know, there's a person here who's begging that I can give something to and I can talk to them, it's amazing how giving and serving pulls me out of hopelessness and despair. Because in the end, I don't have anything to be hopeless about. I don't have anything to despair about.
Based on something you said just a moment ago, a comment that I love is practice hope. How do you practice hope?
So here's one of the things I really do. I don't allow myself to read 15 bad things when I'm surfing the internet. I won't do that. And I make sure that I look at Upworthy every single day to see. I want to see good stories too. I don't only want to see bad stories, because the truth is more people, and I don't care who you are, most people will attest to this, there are more good people than bad people, and there are more good stories than bad stories every single day on this planet and every single day in this city. But for a variety of reasons that we now understand from a neuroscience perspective, from an evolutionary perspective, it turns out we gravitate towards the bad stories. They're more compelling to us because when we hear them, they release a lot of juices and a lot of adrenaline, and flight-fight response is a much, much more primitive response, so we have to be aware, which means we now have to train ourselves to actually, yeah, oh yeah, right, there are many, many, many more good stories happening every single day in my life and people's lives around me than the bad stories. And that really is an exercise. It's a practice in reading the news. How you read the news, how you listen to the news, what you read. And I'm not being Pollyannish and say don't know what's bad and happening in the world. But even in these demonstrations that are happening all around the country, in every one of those demonstrations, there are more positive stories that are the sources of hope for the demonstration and protest itself. I'll give you an example. On Wednesday night, two Wednesday nights ago, when the marches first began, so I walked from 71st Street with my 23-year-old daughter to the Brooklyn Bridge. And it was late at night. I was definitely I'm 57. I was one of the grayer-haired people. And every like 15, 20 blocks, you had to sit down. You sat down. There was like a die-in or a sit-in in the middle of the block. And the police were allowing it for 3, 4, 5 minutes. Someone would speak, and then we'd move to the next, like, big intersection. Well, at 57, it's a lot harder to sit on the street than it was for my daughter at 23. I cannot tell you, every time there was somebody who wanted to help me up with a joke that I'm a gray beard, or come on, we got to help this gray-haired guy. And I looked around, and I could see how people were talking to each other. I could see how people were helping each other, how people were trying to protest and sync together. I said, gosh, What's the real story here? The story isn't only what's really, really problematic in the country right now, this next level of racism that we're going to have to address, right? The other part of the story is look at all these people. Look at all these people at 11:30 at night walking to the Brooklyn Bridge.
Erwin, this is the part of the interview where I feel like I'm stepping back into desert spirituality, and I only do this with you. In desert spirituality, the practice was for people to go and find someone who spends a lot of time in meditation and thought and address that person saying, what's the word? What's the word for today? I always need to ask you that because you always have one. What is the message? What is the word for this Hanukkah season?
It's hard to get it to one word, but I think it's look, it's always love and hope. I mean, those are always the words. But if I want to be really right now, the most important thing we can do is not protest out of anger, but out of righteous indignation. And the difference between anger and righteous indignation is so profound. If we really believe we're all in this together, including the people with whom we deeply disagree, including the people who have, for a variety of reasons, very distorted ways of behaving in the world, but if we really believe we're all in this together, we're going to have to begin to understand the partial truths. And maybe that's what it is, partial truths. The partial truths, I didn't say 50-50 truths, but the partial truths of the people with whom we disagree. Now, I'm not talking about ISIS. Maybe that's going a little too far. But when you look around this country and the many, many good people in this country, the predominance of goodness in this country, yes, there are real systemic problems because all people build things and then have systemic problems about what they build because we're imperfect. But if we can just begin to understand, to listen, maybe listen, listen real, maybe listen's the word. We need to listen. The biggest thing is that voices are not being heard. And when voices are not being heard, they do everything from blow up things to go into despair. We have to listen. And those with more privilege have to listen. They just, it's the Spider-Man rule. Whoever has more power, whoever has more privilege, simply has more responsibility.
Rabbi Erwin Kula is president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He's the author of the book Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. Erwin, it really is always great to talk with you. Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio, and happy Hanukkah.
Thank you so much, and Merry Christmas.
Before we go, in wrapping up its work for the year, the U.S. Senate took a step that I see as immensely important. On December 12th, it approved President Obama's nominee for Ambassador-at-Large for Religious Freedom. Certainly, finally filling vacancies such as that of Surgeon General garnered more headlines. But the conflicts we see across the globe, so often disguised in hidden behind and misrepresented as motivated by religious faith, have an enormous impact on the well-being and sometimes the very survival of countless human beings. There is a vital role for a superpower committed to religious freedom, as imperfect as that commitment has at times been, in addressing that value across the globe. And that's why I am delighted that the new ambassador for religious freedom is a man I've known for many years, deeply respect and consider a valued friend. Rabbi David Saperstein served for years on the Interfaith Alliance Board of Directors and has served for decades as director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism. He was the first chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and he is the first non-Christian to head up the State Department's Religious Freedom Office. When David steps into this position, he not only achieves a remarkable capstone to what has been a long and successful career, he brings to our nation's foreign policy a wealth of knowledge and a fierce dedication to religious freedom and the rights of religious minorities. David's work has always been guided by the Jewish commandment to repair the world. He has now been given an incredible platform to do just that. Congratulations to David, and good promises for all of us. Now, one more thing. A few weeks ago on this program, I spoke with Malcolm Morris, Executive Vice President of Living Water International and the founder and chairman of the Millennium Water Alliance. Since that broadcast, Congress has moved forward on the legislation Mr. Morris endorsed so earnestly by passing the Water for the World Act of 2014. The bill now moves to President Obama for his signature. At the same time, we received a moving response to that interview about the dire clean water situation in Africa and South America. A listener and ordained minister who's been deeply involved in protesting the man-made water crisis facing the residents of Detroit, right here in the United States, highlighted the irony of a population in this country not being able to take clean water for granted, as we had suggested that almost all Americans can. In fact, our listener pointed out that two representatives of the UN High Commission for Human Rights visited the city in October and were clearly shocked and angry at what they saw in one of the wealthiest countries in the world. And so, while it is essential to continue pressuring the administration for action on water for critically poor nations, it is crucial to not overlook unmet basic human needs wherever that happens, and that includes here at home. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this past week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today as you consider your end-of-the-year giving plans. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief and share the stories that you find compelling. Share them with your friends. The same goes for Twitter. We're at twitter.com/stateofbelief. It's a great way for you to be an active part of getting these important voices to reach more people at a time when the noise in social media threatens to drown them out. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. Yes, he was.